Welcome to Voices. I'm Alan Wilcox, Editor-in-Chief of Epidemiology. In 2002, the journal began a project to interview our field's most senior and accomplished practitioners. In these interviews, scientists reflect on their careers, their professional influences, and on the future of epidemiology. The interview you're about to hear is with Henry Blackburn. Dr. Blackburn is currently Professor Emeritus in the Division of Epidemiology and Community Health at the University of Minnesota, where he has worked since 1956. His research focus has been cardiovascular disease risk factors, surveillance, and prevention, and in retirement, the history of cardiovascular disease epidemiology. Dr. Blackburn is also a jazz musician who graciously provided the soundtrack for the Voices interviews. This interview was conducted by Bernie Harlow in 2007.
Hello, my name is Bernie Harlow. I am professor and head of the Division of Epidemiology and Community Health here at the School of Public Health at the University of Minnesota. It is a pleasure to introduce my distinguished colleague who will be enlightening us on his contributions to the history of cardiovascular disease epidemiology as it stands today. Dr. Henry Blackburn is a Mayo Professor Emeritus of Public Health in the Division of Epidemiology and Community Health at the University of Minnesota School of Public Health. He received his MD in medicine from Tulane University and his MS in medicine here at the University of Minnesota. Upon graduation from medical school, Henry's public health service began when he served as a medical missionary in Cuba in 1949. He then spent time as a resident at the American Hospital of Paris, and shortly thereafter became a medical officer in the United States Public Health Service, where he served in Salzburg, Austria, from 1950 to 1953. He returned to the United States to complete his fellowship in medicine at the University of Minnesota, where he was subsequently hired to work with Dr. Ansel Keys on a number of studies related to risk factors associated with cardiovascular disease. He rose through the academic ranks to become a professor of medicine in 1968 and took over the directorship of the Laboratory of Physiological Hygiene in 1972, and then subsequently the chairmanship of epidemiology in 1983, where he continues to be an active faculty member. Along the way, Henry was the driving force behind such landmark studies as the Multi-Risk Factor Intervention Trial, Mr. FIT, the Seven Country Study, the Minnesota Heart Study, and the Minnesota Heart Health Program. Also along the way, Henry received numerous awards, including an honorary doctorate from his alma mater, Tulane University, an honorary fellowship in the Royal College of Physicians and Surgeons of Glasgow, and the Distinguished Research Achievement Award from the American Heart Association. It is truly an honor and a privilege to interview Dr. Henry Blackburn today about his historic contributions to the field of epidemiology. Welcome to This Is Your Life, Henry. So let's start by having you tell us about how you got started in epidemiology. Few people start with the intent of becoming an epidemiologist. Can you describe how your own path brought you to epidemiology?
Sure, Bernie. The path was certainly not linear. I remember as vividly as I remember anything in medical school, the visit of a missionary from the Congo who told us that he had worked in the Congo for 25 years, had never seen a heart attack, had never seen a case of appendicitis or tonsillitis, and that really stuck with me. Just a couple of years later, I was doing medical missionary work also in eastern Cuba, near where Castro was hiding in the mountains, and was also exposed to this issue of mass disease in countries where there was poverty and oppression and ignorance and superstition, realizing that the common diseases were of cultural and social origin. That again was confirmed for me in examining displaced persons in Austria for 3 years. To try to help them get in the States, that the major issues causing the common diseases had very little to do with medicine and genetics and had very little response to medical administrations. They were social, cultural, and economic in nature. So that created the susceptibility. The vectors were several. Getting interested in the cardiovascular part was personal, neurotic, rejected by a Navy recruiting doctor for heart murmur. Who was it that said, facing the guillotine really focuses your mind, but facing a heart murmur focused mine. And a month later, it was not found, and I was in the Navy, and that was over, but it got me interested in cardiovascular. When I got back to the States, I started working with a German cardiographer here in Minnesota. And again, in cardiovascular function, did a thesis, very pedestrian research on the duration of the spatial configuration of the ventricular activation curve. But it taught me survey methods. I had to put on my uniform and go out to the naval base and recruit all these fellows, examine them, exercise them, measure them. Mm-hmm. It gave me experience in measurement, error mm-hmm. of measurement, repeat variability of measurement, distributions, normal, abnormal, yep. simple statistical tests, marvelous preparation for later. All that took place where Dr. Simonson, this cardiographer, had an appointment in Ansel Keys Laboratory of Physiological Hygiene. And that was for many years under the Memorial Stadium, under the bleachers, Stadium Gate 27. And it was a very exciting place intellectually. On the edge at the beginning of this very romantic period in cardiovascular disease epidemiology. Mm-hmm. At the end of my residency, faced with the choice of being an assistant on a medical service locally and working with Ansel Keys, I accepted with Ansel. Didn't ask him how much he paid. Next day found out he didn't pay much. Went into practice to support my research. And I was told by a very discouraged head of medicine that I would never be in the elite of internal medicine in this country if I went to work with those crazy guys doing those weird things under the stadium. I did it anyway. It was important. They were at the threshold of a brand new field of prevention research. That's how I got in.
I think we both feel a passion for what we do, and obviously you have a tremendous passion for wanting to do work under the stadium. So when you think about the work that you were doing under the stadium and the epidemiology that was being practiced back then, how do you see it having changed from back then to how it's practiced today?
How many ways it is different? I suppose principally, epidemiology at that time was not done by epidemiologists. Particularly in the cardiovascular field, it was done by people who were passionately, as you say, and expertly involved with some area of cardiovascular function or anatomy. Biostatisticians, biochemists, physiologists, clinicians, in Ansel case, physiology. There were no chronic disease epidemiologists in mid-century. The few that there were in respiratory disease, rheumatic fever. Mm. There were a couple of exceptions of public health people who had the vision of the epidemiologic transition, heart disease going up, other communicable diseases going down. Mm-hmm. Joseph Mountain, who introduced the Framingham Heart Study in 1948. Mm-hmm. But generally, cardiovascular epidemiology was started by people who were involved and on the front lines of studying heart disease and vascular function. This was a major difference. The obvious differences of lack of sophistication, lack of methods that actually got us together, talking, mm-hmm. created a very collegial environment. The obvious differences in computation and data storage and data handling and analysis. I can still hear the the horror of those Friedan mechanical calculators that they were using in our lab, the hum when they became electrified, and remember the PDP-8 we got that had a memory of 4K.
Right.
The next one, late 60s, 2 megs. So that was a major change. The difference in leadership, medical, the computation, different, much more relaxed in the production of research, finding funds. Tenure is a major difference. Completely changed the picture of epidemiology in the late 60s and 70s. Before that, we had long apprenticeships. We were under no pressure. We became gradually and comfortably more skilled. Now it's 6 years up and out.
Yeah, true.
So it really modified the environment.
Yeah.
Many other changes we can talk about later in our conversation about the medical directions in contrast to the social directions of epidemiology.
Right. I remember the cards that I had.
Really?
I had to stack them up this long, bring them to
the
computer.
Oh, I didn't even get to the cards.
Get to the computer, let it chuck all night long and come back and look at my output, which was, of course, an error. And then I'd have to do it all over again and wait another night. It's amazing how the computer technology has changed.
Better an error than having those cards all in a rack on the wall and then being right in the middle of your analysis on a weekend where you've left your family, you're doing a study, it has to be done, and the rack falls off the wall and your cards are on the floor.
Right. Oh, God.
Anyway.
Thank God we don't have to go back to that. So I'm sure I know the answer to this, but tell me what person you would single out as having most strongly influenced your career.
You can get us both in a lot of trouble by asking me the single most important person in my career.
Well, let's say if you had to rank them, knowing that there are many people who have had a tremendous influence in your career, let's look at the top one or two.
I'll evade you just a little bit, as a politician would, and say clearly Ansel Keys, because he recruited me, he encouraged me, he gave me an assignment to convert clinical medicine to his needs for counting bodies and diseases and phenomena in the population, right down my alley. But I would also mention Jeffrey Rose, with whom I wrote a survey manual, and Jerry Stamler, who gave me an opportunity to work in clinical trials and got me all involved. So those three people, with Ansel clearly the central character.
So collaboration is essential to successful epidemiologic studies. We certainly know that, and we're moving away from the silo approach, and we're really moving more into collaborative kinds of relationship with our colleagues. What have you found to be the most important ingredients of a good collaboration, and with whom have you had your best collaborations?
Common interest, mutual interest. Someone who is non-defensive in communications. Those are the requirements of good collaboration, I think. The best one I ever had was with a man by the name of Tsukitami Tominaga at University of Maryland. And we worked together on the predictive value of the electrocardiogram in the coronary drug project. And we interacted for 2-3 years. It was delightful collaboration. Collaborating with Jeffrey Rose and writing a manual was marvelous to get his clarity of thinking and his parsimony of language. Collaborating with Ansel Keys and writing a review article, and the happiest, and I don't like the idea of pride, but the proudest moment was when the editor said he couldn't tell where Ansel's writing left off and mine began, and I had so admired his writing that thrilled me. These were great collaborations, particularly the coronary drug project, which was a happy trial, conveniently, competently done, collegially done, and so those are my major collaborations.
Great. So I know we talked about the person who most influenced your becoming an epidemiologist, but whom would you regard as the two or three most influential epidemiologists that you admire the most?
Well, you give me two or three instead of one.
I gave you two or three this time.
All right, I'll avoid that and deviate from that just a little too. There's so many important for different reasons. I'm going to mention a name you might not know, James Watt, a diarrhea doctor, a public health service officer in the Southwest studying diarrheal diseases, the transmission of polio. This young fellow, for whatever reason, was appointed head of the National Heart Institute in 1952, the second director. And that was the most important thing that's happened in my field and had the most influence. He was able to fight the battles of epidemiology, to institute epidemiology as an equal discipline, equal administratively, equal conceptually, maybe not equal funding, but certainly into the program in a way that's persisted to this day. And all our work since that time is based on him having established that. You don't think that the heads of those institutes, from the labs and from the clinic, would have given us a thing over the years if he hadn't fixed that into the policy of the institute. But if you want me to go on from there, I defy you to help me distinguish between Bradford Hill and Richard Dahl and Jeffrey Rose and Archie Cochran and on and on. You want to stop me there.
Okay. So certainly there are all these incredibly influential epidemiologists that we both have tremendous admiration for. Now think about your own contributions, and what would you say is your most influential paper that you published?
Again, we have the most, huh?
Mm-hmm.
I'm going to throw a story at you for that. Mm-hmm. It's a nice story about Ansel Keys, who was invited to the first meeting of WHO, World Health Organization, to discuss arteriosclerosis and the great problem of humanity that it represented. A dozen experts from around the world are there, and Sir George Pickering was there. And Ansel, in his usual bluntness, bombast, in fact, propounded his diet heart theory with great vigor, was quite taken up when Sir George Pickering asked him, if you would please, Professor Keys, tell us the most important single piece of evidence you have to back up this theory of yours. And Ansel fell in the trap. He identified a piece of evidence, and of course Sir George and the distinguished experts were able to diminish that almost to the ground. Too late for Ansel to discuss the body of evidence that's necessary to create a hypothesis. And Ansel was stung and defeated by a debater's trick that he shouldn't have fallen to. So now you're asking me the debater's trick. And what was it you asked me? most important. Oh dear. I would rather be remembered for a body of knowledge, and I would like to be remembered for providing an environment where people with a lot of disciplines can get together and work and focus on a major medical and public health issue.
Which manuscript do you feel most personally, proud of, even though it may or may not have had the notoriety that either you wanted to or just for some reason it was under the radar scheme? What's your most satisfying manuscript that you've published? Or maybe it's not a manuscript, maybe it's a book or a book chapter.
The only thing worse than asking me which was the most is saying about what I was the most proud.
Yes.
When my background doesn't allow one to be pride. Pride is a sin, you see. Mm-hmm. Satisfaction, perhaps. A review article on a public health view of mass hyperlipidemia buried in somebody else's book. Mm-hmm. An article on the origin of modern Western epidemic diseases in our evolutionary legacy as hunter-gatherers. Mm-hmm. The article that is remembered, of course, is Electrocardiographic Classification for Population Studies, the Minnesota Code. Classic citation, thousands of times, that sort of thing. It's a little disturbing that that is what would be the contribution. Something that's obsolete, a dichotomous classification 50 years ago, but that's the way it is. I expect to be remembered. Is that what we're talking about?
No, we're talking about your most satisfying manuscript or publication.
Those are the papers that are most satisfying to
okay.
me.
Okay. So how did you choose your research questions to study?
Well, the methods in electrocardiography in the clinic that Ansel Keys needed for his surveys was assigned to me. Uh-huh. That's often the way. We're given a database or we're given a charge and we go off on it. I chose smoking characteristics of smokers and non-smokers as my topic early, mm-hmm. because there was a grant available, you know, that issue. Mm-hmm. I really chose the big issues, the Minnesota Heart Survey and the Minnesota Heart Health Program, out of my experience in the field, seeing the remarkable cultural differences in cardiovascular disease, knowing that you had to measure them in a population, understand them, relate them to risk characteristics of the population, study their trends over time, knowing that initiated in the 70s, the Minnesota Heart Study, doing that in preparation for intervening in communities trying to change the disease experience. So it came from observations in the field. Hmm.
So now thinking about some of your major interests outside of epidemiology, what are some of your favorite activities that you like to get involved in?
I think family and music, lifetime. Certainly, 20 years hobby was this business of evolutionary medicine and our legacy affecting our susceptibility to affluent diseases. And the last decade, outside my responsibilities, retired or before retirement, has been in the history of cardiovascular disease epidemiology, and that is really fun. 100 oral histories from great legends, 150 biographies I've written of these people, several thousand references, an archive of some very original materials and writings from Ansel Keys and John Goffman, the nuclear expert, also lipid expert, Fred Epstein, our great leader, Cynic Fayfar, head of WHO, cardiovascular, and then in addition to the archive, producing a website with the support of you and our division and our dean in our school and the National Library of Medicine in preparation for a book on the history of research in cardiovascular disease prevention. That's been my extracurricular activity. And I can assure you, historians have as much fun as, I won't say blondes, but as biologists. So.
Excellent, excellent. So now thinking about epidemiology as a discipline, what do you think is the most important contributions that it has made to society in your lifetime?
Or in general?
Or in general.
Actually, identifying the causal factors of disease and the causal factors of healthy populations, establishing in trials their ability to be modified, providing the sound scientific basis for preventive practice and for public health policy. That's the principal contribution of epidemiology, I think. The secondary is the cues that it gives us the clues that it gives us to mechanisms and new ideas about disease.
Mm. Excellent. So now thinking about epidemiology today, How are we doing? What do you think of the health of epidemiology as a profession and discipline today?
Well, there's good news and there's bad news. Most people prefer to listen to optimists. It's exciting what's going on. I'm impressed by the youth, by the competence of our youth, our young epidemiologists, their ability to do studies and to do analyses on their own or collaboratively. The fact that we are a mature profession with a continuing vision, and we're oriented to do good works for the common good.
Any risks?
And the risks and directions that are on the bad news side of that are the fact that we have become really an instrument of the medical strategy. And I won't get conspiratorial here, but the medical strategy focuses on the individual. And in our focus now, in our culture of the individual, epidemiology has now become a part of that culture. And we're working on individual risk and the refinements of that. And we have turned, hopefully not forever or too seriously, away from our mission for the common good, for the population phenomena. I won't ride that any further, but I am concerned about the culture of the individual rather than the culture of the common good. Hmm. And epidemiology's role in that. The medicalization of prevention is a serious issue, and we're playing a role in that.
Do you see an optimistic future, or what are your predictions of the future for our field?
Well, I guess there are two kind of crystal ball gazers. There's a kind that really is able, like some of our futurists, to analyze trends and joining with politics and economy to produce something 15 years down the line or more, as we would do it, predicting basis on what we think the need is and what we would hope. And I would hope we would be turning away from this culture of the individual and this focus on the individual and the mechanisms, learning as much as we can about that, but to our larger view of what motivates the common diseases and the great burdens of society and what influences a healthy society.
So about 12 or so years ago, I wrote a commentary on coping with the frustrations of epidemiologic research. Thinking about your role as a senior investigator and a pioneer in this field, what would you say is the single most important piece of advice that you can give to new epidemiologists coming, newly graduating out of their program?
You won't let me roll out my list of admonitions. You have to hear the single most important piece. So I will.
You can say, give me five.
You said
give me the
single.
Top five.
You said single.
Okay.
And I will create my own platitude, which is do a good job of what's before you. That's the only way you get to do another job and a better job. Beyond that, I advise students and young epidemiologists to know themselves. Know thyself. Are you an idea person? Need some help in organization, administration? Are you a doer? Need to spend more time meditating, thinking? Are you a methodist? By that I mean a methodologist, where you're going to produce a new method that'll improve science. Where you stand, you need all these qualities, but you need to know where you stand, what kind of person you are, and to put yourself with individuals that complement your function. And along with that, my advice is to be an apprentice to a good person in a strong institution. That's the best way to work through the problems. That's the best way to get your experience. That's the best way to meet the people in the field. There's so many people that are going out after having done their theses on somebody else's database and being thrown to the wolves. They've done some teaching, and teaching is the best way to learn, of course. But they are being thrown to the wolves to perform without this apprenticeship. So get with a good institution and be an apprentice as long as your family will allow you to be one.
Like ours. Okay, Henry, so to just finish up here, I've been asking you a lot of questions, but I do want to give you an opportunity to have the last word here. So is there anything else that you would like to add to this interview that you think is very important to convey?
I need a soapbox. Just a little bit more about this personalized medicine. The credo of the National Institutes of Health is from the bench to the bedside. Never do you hear from the bench to the bedside to the population outside. Whenever I hear that credo, and when the staff says it, I get up and say, and to the population outside, such that when I rotated off the advisory council, NIH, I was told goodbye by the claim that if Henry Blackburn had his way, this would be the National Institute of Preventive Cardiology rather than heart, lung, and blood disease. And they were right. But their slogan now is personalized medicine, with the dream that we can identify all the individual susceptibilities and target our therapy to that. Another story, Arnold Motulsky, distinguished physician, geneticist, who once said to me, Henry, we are that far, meaning a very small distance, and this was 15 years ago, from being able to determine by a few measurements the real susceptibility and vulnerability of an individual, so that the likes of you, I think he said, your ilk, won't have to bludgeon the public with your ideas about diet and lifestyle. That's the dream, personalized medicine. It's a pipe dream, and it is entirely away from the phenomena that cause our common diseases, cause our epidemics. And that is where I think the future is, in that space, that unexplored space between the socioeconomic, cultural components and the disease and the health of a population. If we can identify the mechanisms for that transfer and modify them or help them be changed, we will get back to our original mission, which is the health of the population.
Very good. Thank you very much, Henry. It was an honor.
Thanks for listening to Voices, a project of the journal Epidemiology. We hope that you enjoyed it. You may also be interested in a short video clip of this interview, which you can access through the journal's website. An edited version of this interview was published in the May 2008 issue of the journal.